Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen. I'm your host, Jeff Palermo. And this week, we're going to be taking a look at 1980s time travel military film, The Final Countdown. Final Countdown, not a lot of background information available about The Final Countdown. It was sort of a Kirk Douglas vehicle. His son, I guess his name is Peter Douglas, was involved in producing the thing. There are four screenwriters having to do with this script. None of them I recognize from anything. For whatever reason, you know, the production company that did this, they wanted it as a vehicle for Douglas, and Douglas wanted his son to be involved as a producer and, you know, pretty much got it off the ground. One thing about this film, which was kind of amazing in pre-Transformers era, is the involvement of the U.S. military was extensive, and extensive to the point where the shooting schedule was, the way they described it, the shooting schedule was sort of at the whim of the military liaison who was there. So if they needed to run exercises or something else needed to happen, you know, they could cancel at any moment what was on the shooting script, which I'm sure is a very tricky thing. And you know, when you're filming a multi-million-dollar movie and suddenly, you know, the Navy schedules a joint exercise and, you know, all of your props are gone. You know, for this film, it really works. It's really because of the they were able to put cameras in so many places. And they filmed extensively on the nuclear carrier, the USS Nimitz. And so, and the amount of footage garnered because of the military involvement, really, I don't know, it makes it, it's not, this is not the greatest movie ever made. The military's involvement allows them to really give you a sense of realism in terms of anything connected with the carrier, you know, and the fact that then they put this whole thing in a speculative lens is just, I don't know, it's kind of a, it's a little favorite of mine that I like. It was directed by a guy named Don Taylor, born in the 1920s. He was an actor for a while, and then he was a director. In the 70s, he kind of got into some genre, directed this film in the 1980, but in the 70s, he directed Escape from the Planet of the Apes, which is the third Apes film, Damien Omen 2, second in the Omen trilogy, the 70s Island of Dr. Moreau, which I remember being kind of a cool film. I have to revisit it to see if it's podcast worthy. So, all right, let's jump into the film. The film starts with a blank screen, and we hear sort of aviation crosstalk, and it's dark, so we don't see anything. The first shot we see is an F-14 Tomcat taking off from a land airstrip, and it's, again, the first in, you will hear me say over and over again, the many, many wonderful aerial photography shots in this film. They are legion, I should say. They really linger on it, slow, majestic rising of the plane, and it kind of goes out into the distance and then does a really incredible turn really right up in the straight up incredible angle of attack it was able to achieve probably on afterburners. And then we cut to sort of the credits over the, you know, how they do the credits over the beginning of the movie. So we just see a lot of cars and vehicles, you know, as our heroes get into position, as it were. We see a black limousine enter a naval base. The driver you hear announce Mr. Tideman, and that's a name that we're going to hear, you know, as we go forward in the film. Quickly, we are understanding we are in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. You can see shots of the Arizona Memorial, and we're on a military base at Pearl. And we're introduced to a gentleman named Lasky, who's played by Martin Sheen. And he's taken by helicopter from that base to the USS Nimitz. Now, before he leaves, the guy in this limousine is sort of there to see him off. I guess his name is Tideman. He's at the back of the limo. You know, Lasky moves towards the back of the car wanting to thank the man. We're not sure why yet. We'll find out very quickly. And the driver gets out and sort of stops him. Says, you know, Mr. Tideman doesn't, you know, see anyone, or he was just here to see you off. And it's kind of an odd thing. Very mysterious man in the back of the car. You know, who is he? Of course, we will eventually discover that if we make it to the end of the film. Then we cut to the credits proper and the title of the film, and there's a wonderful theme. It's a wonderful theme song composed by this guy named John Scott, who composed for lots of Hollywood films in the 60s and 70s. I was unaware of his name when I rewatched this film, but the main theme of Final Countdown is really great. A lot of the film music is very expansive. Reminds me of Goldsmith stuff for Total Recall, like this expansive, lots of horns, just big, you know. And I'm sure, being a quasi-military movie, that, you know, they leaned heavily on the horns, as it were. But it's beautiful, and again, you're in the blue sky, this aerial photography. They do a nice slow flyby of the Arizona Monument. And then obviously Pearl Harbor is going to play an extremely large role in this film. So they really set the scene, which is great. And, you know, we're starting off with just, this film is very well shot in its exteriors. Ships and the planes and the helicopters and everything that we see, this beautiful blue sky. These shots have not dated the film at all. I mean, this film in a lot, almost all of its exterior shots is undated. I mean, undated. If you showed this film and, you know, you took a bunch of these scenes and you put it to a modern movie, you wouldn't skip a beat. And it's just really, really, to me, kudos to, and I think that the director wasn't involved in some of the second unit stuff, which is the aerial shots. So whoever these Air Force dudes were, or Navy guys who were getting these shots of the planes in flight, my God, I mean, unbelievable. So now this is a slow reveal of the Nimitz. We start by seeing a wake in the water as a helicopter containing Lasky is, you know, catching up to the Nimitz. And then the camera does this flyby, and it's very dramatic. And we start at a very low angle as if we are next to the ship near the water. And we see all the elevators. And then when it finally gets to the bow of the ship, the camera goes up and pans around the bow. And, oh, my God. I mean, you know, part of me in this film, I am not a jingoistic military guy, meaning, you know, I am not for United States military running around the world and just doing whatever they want. Not at all. But I am a military geek in that I love, I am so appreciative. And as a kid, my God, I loved planes and rockets and boats and tanks. And there is something incredibly geeky about these amazingly designed machines. I mean, you know, the USS Nimitz is a nuclear-powered carrier. First of all, the nuclear reactor is powering this thing. It could go without fuel for something like 10 to 15 years. You know, it has to put back to port because it has to feed the humans, and it needs, you know, fuel for the planes. But the Nimitz could stay out, and you know, any nuclear-powered carrier can stay out at sea for, you know, a decade without refueling. And it's quite extraordinary when you think about it. Everything that it can power on the ship with the steam from the reactor. I mean, you know, probably one of the most amazing things human beings have ever designed and put to use. So I'm kind of a geek when it comes to military hardware, I got to say. I know that the use it's put to is pretty horrific. Unfortunately, I can separate those two parts of myself, especially when it's cinema. So hope I didn't offend anybody, but, you know, that's just kind of wanted to let you know where I'm at with this stuff. You know, part of me was thinking too when I was looking at the Nimitz, some of the, just the ships and the planes, it's about as science fiction as real life gets. I mean, you know, military hardware, up to the date, cutting edge military hardware is about as sci-fi as you can possibly get because it's pushing the boundaries of all kinds of things. So, you know, the stealth technology. I mean, if that's not science fiction, man, you know, I don't know what is. Also, because of this, because of the military's involvement here, the realism in this film is off the charts. It is off the charts. You know, we start when Lasky gets to the Nimitz. They're filming on the deck, the bloody deck of the thing. And you can tell. And, you know, when they're close to the helicopter and the jets that are they're alighting, they're real planes. And we see all the little markings on the side and the warnings for the jet intake and all the hazardous and warnings on the helicopters and all that. And it's just, my God. I mean, it's almost like a documentary. It's so amazingly real. And then we cut to the bridge. We see Mr. Kirk Douglas, Hollywood royalty. And we see a wonderful landing of an F-14 on the Nimitz. The camera is with the F-14, and we see the tail hook kind of come down because this camera's on the Tomcat. There's also, there must have been a plane in front of it because we can see the whole landing from the front, and we can see it from the rear, we can see it from the cockpit, and how the tail hook comes down and how it catches the arrestor wire. Amazing, amazing shots of this activity. And we meet the CAG, or the what they call the commander of the carrier air group. They just call it, he is the CAG, as it were. Battlestar Galactica fans will recognize the terminology because they cribbed it from, you know, the Navy as well. And we get a throwaway line. Someone on the Nimitz asks Lasky who he is and that he works for Tideman Industries. So again, there's that name, Tideman, and pay attention to that name because, again, it will return. And we hear that Lasky is aboard to do some analysis for Tideman Industries. And we hear that that's the company that designed and built the Nimitz, which I don't think is true, frankly, but works for the story big time. Again, you know, the mystery around Tideman. Who is this man that, you know, has a whole company behind him, so on and so forth. So Lasky's on board, and we get subtle indications that the weather is about to change. We see some lightning off in the distance. A little bit of rain, you know, comes on the front, and then it starts to rain for real. Captain Yellen, who is Kirk Douglas, is very surprised by the weather because, you know, obviously being a Navy man, you know, very much living and dying by the up-to-the-minute weather reports that they get being at sea. Then we cut to sort of the meteorologist's ward room, and we see that they're kind of freaked out by this storm that's just appeared out of nowhere. It's heading their way. Then we cut to Lasky being put in a cabin, and it's an important plot point that this cabin adjoins Ferrantino's cabin. And Ferrantino's character is named Owen. Owens, I think it's Robert Owen. And they're connecting cabins. And again, I think they filmed this on the Nimitz. I'm not positive, but the cabins look incredibly realistic. You know, they don't look like Hollywood sexy, as some things can be. It's very functional, very drab. Lasky pulls the bed down. There's a little bar on the end of it. I mean, that seems to me, you know, like very economical Navy design, right? A big fat bar to pull the bed down. Then Lasky pops the door open to Owen's cabin, and he sees that he's kind of a Pearl Harbor buff. Lots of photos of Pearl Harbor and, you know, obviously 1941, the attack pinned to the wall. We see some manuscripts, and we gather that Owen is working on a book on the subject. Not so surprising, being a guy in the Navy and stationed at Pearl Harbor. So it's kind of cool, all kind of connected. Then we cut to Yellen on the bridge, and we're getting the information that the storm started to interfere with the radio signals between the Nimitz and its aircraft that it has launched. And then we cut back to Owen's cabin, and he surprises Lasky. And he's very angry about the fact that Lasky just busted into his, you know, cabin, and talks about how privacy is extremely important on the ship. Brief dialogue, you know, Owen's not really pleased with this guy. And yet Lasky sort of tells Owen that he thinks the manuscript is terrific. He thinks he's a really good writer. Owen sort of queries him about what is his real job. And he says, I'm a systems analyst for Tideman. And basically, I observe how things are done. And I see if there's any ways that systems can be improved, processes can be improved. So kind of like a internal consultant to the Navy, as it were. Now, we've got one last plane. All the planes in the Nimitz have landed. There's one last plane inbound that has not landed. So now we get more of this weird anomaly on the scope. We get a quick shot outside the ship, and we see this incredible, and I just love these shots, this blue, massive blue wormhole. It's kind of a portal that is where the storm is. And it's amazing. Still to this day, I think, I just watched a Blu-ray copy of this film. The storm is incredible. I mean, it still plays, man. I think the effects are not dated in the slightest. They're a bit dated when the ship's going through. And yet it's shot in such a cool way that, I don't know, I don't mind it at all. So it looks very cool that this kind of portal, like, it looks like a portal to infinity, you know, when you see it. And it's got this cool blue glow. Really neat, man, really neat. So Yellen sends all of the carrier groups. So carriers travel in groups. They are the center of cruisers, and it used to be battleships. I think battleships have kind of are done now. There's sort of missile cruisers now and lighter boats and, you know, patrol boats. And he sends the whole pack of them back to Pearl to get out of the storm because a ship the size of the Nimitz, I guess, can weather larger weather events than maybe other ships can much better. So we've got the Nimitz alone, which is good for the story. Then we see them, this plane that's coming in is in trouble. There's two types of planes that I can see on the ship are I think they're A-6 Intruders, which I think are Grumman aircraft, and they're more patrol and sort of bombers. And then we have the Tomcats. And I think this Intruder is heading in, and we hear some scuttlebutt on the radio that, you know, something's wrong with the ship, and he can't really control it as best he could. So we see the Nimitz being rigged to take the ship. And basically what we're getting is that the plane's arrestor hook is malfunctioning, so it can't stop itself. So we see this rig, which is, you know, essentially this huge net that will catch the plane. And what I found out from a brief check into some of the special features is that this was real, that they didn't plan this, and that when they were filming, a plane was in trouble. And the film crew asked the captain of the ship if they could film it, and he allowed it. So when you see this ship coming down, Pardon me with any military folks when I say ship and I mean plane. It's a slip of the tongue. When the plane lands and you see it land into this net, it really happened, and they really recovered the plane that way. So kind of cool little factoid. So in the middle of this, when they finally recover the plane, everyone sees this huge blue funnel. The Nimitz goes through the storm. And there are some great effects. You know, what they do to make this really cool is they film a lot of the crew sort of holding their head. I guess it's like the sound is really gets into people's heads and drives them kind of nuts. And a lot of people are screaming. And what they do is they film kind of the shots of the film where the crew is in profile, and you see the crew is kind of in profile and very dark, and right behind them is this blue funnel or this blue energy all around them. And it's really cool. It's very artistic, actually. For a film like this, you know, it's very artfully done, and there are certain very striking scenes when they go through the storm this first time that they take their time. Really is creepy and really, really good sci-fi, you know, since no one really knows what the hell's going on. So kudos to the director and production team. Really cool. So they make it through the storm, and they're once again on the open sea, and they all kind of wake up. I guess the storm had kind of put them down. They're still waiting for the lone, I guess it's a Corsair, A6 Corsair. So yeah, maybe it is an A6. So it's nowhere to be seen. They're still looking for their ship, and then we do a general quarters drill, which I guess is the drill they call when a ship is about to go into battle, and everyone on the ship gets to their assigned duties. And, you know, with a lot of shots of guys preparing and getting their gear on and running around and, you know, prepping ships and prepping planes, as it were, and really cool. And then, of course, at that moment, you know, they see the plane and the pilot, and it lands, and the crash teams respond when the plane crashes down. So now they've got all their plans. And now we get what I find is the most fun part of films like this. The Nimitz starts to get information in dribs and drabs that they're no longer where or when they think they are. This, to me, this is the most fun part of these kind of movies, where you just, as the crew and the captain and all the main characters learn what's going on little by little. It's just, it's such a pleasure. And this is a B-movie through and through. There's no character development. There's no oop themes here. There's no pathos with characters. And, you know, it's a classic B-movie. No backstories. No one died on because of someone's fault and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's not much deep drama in the film. So you can kind of just go on board as a fun film. And this is classic. In a sense, a classic sci-fi novel put to screen, if it was a novel, which, you know, it wasn't. But anyway, so I love this part of the film. So right away, they discover that they cannot communicate with the rest of the fleet. And they can't sense any of the ships that they had sent away. And the only thing they can sense is what they say is low-power radio transmissions. Before the storm, we had seen several shots of this Russian trawler, which the Russians used to, I don't know, they may still do, but in the Cold War, the Russians disguised these incredible, you know, spy vessels as trawlers, fishing trawlers, and they used to run them, you know, just in international waters on the West Coast and the East Coast. It's fairly well known, like all sides knew that the Russians were doing it, and we knew, and there's nothing we could do about it. So they used this in the film, because they see a Russian trawler fairly nearby the Nimitz in the beginning of the film. Now it's vanished completely. Like, they don't know what happened to it. So again, they can't communicate with anyone. The trawler's gone. They can't find the fleet. Lasky comes out of his cabin, joins the captain on the bridge. Then we get a quick shot of the communications wardroom as one of the communication techs is monitoring this coded signal. And some boss is like, what are you getting? And he's like, I'm getting this code. He's like, well, try and break it. And he's like, I don't have to. He's like, I broke these kind of codes while I was, you know, back in, he mentions about Pacifica or something, I guess back in training. So very cool, cryptic, right? I love it. Then right away, Yellen launches reconnaissance planes, and we see this large double propeller reconnaissance plane launched to have a look around. Then we see another that he sends up an intruder via catapult. And we see the steam catapult in action, which is just so cool how these planes are launched with the steam catapults. So then Yellen calls a meeting of his officers, admitting to them he doesn't know what the hell it is, but he has to consider that it could have been a nuclear strike by the Russians, could have taken out all the communications. The only thing he can theorize that has gone wrong, the comm officer is there and, again, reiterates to the captain that they can't communicate with anyone. They've only found some, like, AM band stuff. And so the comm guy turns on the AM band and we hear, like, a Jack Benny show, you know, circa 1940. It was really cool. And so then he orders out more air patrols and we get shots of them loading ordnance and, you know, pilots preparing, getting on their planes. And we see the use of the external elevators, which, you know, carriers store their planes in the belly, but they have to get to the flight deck via these external elevators on the side of the ship. And we see one in action. And it's just one amazing shot after another. My military geek side was just, you know, every time I see this film, I just love seeing these planes. I love seeing all this tech and beautifully shot, you know, well rendered, great camera work. We get a cut to a pleasure boat and we see the back of it. It's called the Gatsby. And we see some people on it listening to a speech being given by Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the radio. And we see a gentleman named Senator Samuel Chapman, played by Charles Durning, who's a big favorite of mine. I love Charles Durning. There's a woman on the boat. Her name is Laurel Scott. And a third gentleman, who I think is sort of a colleague of Chapman's. And we hear some scuttlebutt about Chapman possibly being the next vice president. The actress Catherine Ross is playing Laurel Scott. We get a sense that she's writing his speeches and, you know, that she is not only his assistant, but you know, quite a political asset in his corner. There is a dog, I believe it's a collie, on the boat. It starts to bark, and we see two of our tomcats streak by overhead. Again, beautiful aerial shots, incredible, as they just roar by. And when they report the boat, Yellen tells them to hold position. He's going to send a tanker to refuel them. But Chapman looks up, and he's like, you know, they had American markings, but I've never seen anything like that, and they're very confused. So we cut back to the Nimitz, and we hear them listening to a Joe Louis fight on the radio and advertisements circa 1940, you know. Yellen's like, this has got to be a joke. You know, someone has got to be playing a joke on us to see how we're going to react because Lasky's there watching them. So right away, they suspect Lasky, and they suspect that this is all a big put-on so Lasky can kind of watch them in action. However, Yellen is then handed fresh aerial recon photos of Pearl Harbor. Do we look at the photographs and they, you know, they don't look right. Lasky looks at them and he says, you should really call Owen down here and have him look at these photographs. So then we get a refueling sequence of the Tomcats. And, you know, if you don't know this about military fighter planes and other planes, they refuel in midair and they bring tankers out and the tankers snake out a hose that flies behind them. And the fighter jets in the nose, sort of a spout pops up to the right of the nose with this catcher. It's like a big, it's almost like a cone. And the fighters maneuver the cone so that the, you know, heavy end of the refueling hose pops in and they refuel in midair. It's incredible. I mean, and they really, they show the whole thing. It's not very long, but they show an actual in-flight refueling. And it's just, there's nothing more sci-fi than that in a certain sense, you know. So now we're back on the Nimitz. Owens had come down and he's seen the photographs. And he says, he brings down his photographs. And he shows Yellen that, and Yellen's like, where did you get these photographs? He said, I got them from the Smithsonian. Where did you get these? They're pre-World War II. And Yellen tells him these were just taken, you know, a half hour ago. And so everyone's kind of freaked out. Then the radar picks up what they call two low and slow targets, some aircraft, and they vector in the Tomcats. And the Tomcats ID the two planes as Mitsubishi Zeros, the classic attack aircraft the Japanese used in the Pearl Harbor attack, circa, you know, World War II planes, and with the Japanese markings. And they're beautifully shot as well. Wonderful reconstructions of the Zeros. Really incredible. Yellen doesn't know what to do, so he tells them the jets are way high and the Zeros can't track them. They're sort of in their blind spot. And so Yellen basically tells them to tail them and report. And all of the aerial photography with the Zeros, all of it is just so amazing, you know, so beautifully shot. And it's done in really high, bright daylight. So it's incredibly crisp and clear. And the Blu-ray transfer is just, for this stuff, is masterful. Now we're sitting at dinner at the captain's table, and it's basically, you know, Captain Yellen and Owen and Lasky. Lasky, this is the first one to say, listen, you know, one thing you're not considering is that this is possibly real. Yellen is like, who would want us to think we're back in 1941? So he's kind of going at it from that angle of like, who would want to, thinking that this is a trick, who would want to play this kind of trick on them? But Lasky turns the corner and he basically says, look, we went through a really crazy storm. I've never seen any storm like that. I don't think you have either. Time travel is possible. Einstein proved it. And so on and so forth. And so, of course, he lays on the table the very unwelcome notion that they are in 1941 somehow. Then we cut back to the pleasure boat, the Gatsby, and the two Zeros see the pleasure craft and they strafe it. The man that was with Sam Chapman, his friend, is killed right in Chapman's arms. The Jets report the attack, and Yellen still tells them to hold off, and he asks Owen, where would the Japanese task force be on that day? And then Owens gives him the positions, and so Yellen tasks a recon plane to go. So for once and for all, they're going to try to prove it. And if the task force is there, it's pretty much a done deal. And the Zeros make another pass very low. The boat blows up. Chapman and the woman had gotten off the plane. So it's Chapman and her in the water with one of the boat crew men. So there's three people in the water at this point. The boat is gone. The Zeros are now turning for one last pass, and they strafe the water. And they kill the other member of the boat. And so now we have the senator and his secretary are left. So Yellen gives the order for them to harass the Zeros without firing because he still doesn't know what's going on. So the Tomcats kind of head in and there's a whole dogfighting sequence of these F-14 Tomcats and the A-6 Mitsubishi Zeros that's really great. I mean, it's all done for real. And what these pilots can do with the Tomcats is just astonishing. Just astonishing. The Zeros are now headed back to the Nimitz to finish off the senator and his aide, and Yellen finally gives the order for the Tomcats to destroy the Zeros, and one of the Tomcats uses its cannon to take one of the Zeros out, and there's a casualty, one of the pilots, I think, gets out alive, splashes into the water, and the other Tomcat fires a Sidewinder missile at it, blows it out of the sky. And now we quickly get the recon plane that Yellen had sent. It confirms that the entire Japanese task force is in fact where Owen had predicted it would be. And that they're not emitting any radar, which I guess radar was something that was not invented till much later in World War II. I think the British invented it. So it didn't come until later in the war. So it kind of seals the deal. And Yellen is forced to, forced to deal with this fact. So he sends a rescue team to collect the two people in the water. And, of course, they find out that one of the pilots of the Japanese plane has also survived and he has picked up as well. And we see the helicopter rescue of the senator. They really take their time. They show the helicopter coming in and, the snaking the line down. And the woman, when she's brought up, Laurel is asking about her dog. And so Owens jumps in and saves the dog. And it's the beginning of, Owen and Laurel Scott and their romance in this film. And she's grateful that he got the dog. And we're introduced to Sam Chapman. And when Owens asks him who he is, he says, my name is Samuel Chapman. And we can tell that Owens knows him, but doesn't let on. But his face changes. Good, nice little moment by James Ferrantino. And they also pick up the Japanese pilot, and they're all brought aboard the Nimitz. They keep the Japanese pilot in the same area as Chapman and Laurel Scott. Obviously, everyone is under guard. Going through the Japanese pilot's things, and they, from the camera angle, we can see they all look very authentic. They return back to him. They find out about who Chapman is, from Owen's book and all his information, that Chapman actually died. And Sam Chapman is not a real senator. He's fictional for the film, but it's clever that in the history books of this film, that Chapman died that day, where he was lost, missing, with all aboard his boat, but that he was kind of headed for the vice presidential spot, that he would have eclipsed Truman, and in fact would, when FDR had died, would have become president after FDR. So they're talking about changing history. Lasky talks about the grandfather paradox, which you've probably heard of, where if time travel is possible and I go back in time and I kill my grandfather, how will I be born? Or if I kill my father, how would I be able to do that if at that point then I would never have been born? They don't really do much with that in this film, but we do get the sense that Chapman would have been killed by the second strafing run of the Zeros. And the fact that he wasn't, now they've already changed things. Then we have this tense moment where Owens goes to visit Chapman and Laurel Scott, and the dog gets loose, and distracts everyone. And in two rooms over, the Japanese pilot takes an MP's weapon and kills that MP and another MP. And Lasky is also down there with Owens and all of them. So the Japanese pilot now is holding them all hostage. We see Marines kind of lining up outside the wardroom, but they don't break in yet. In the interior shots in a lot of this part of the film, there's some bad focus problems where, you know, they really have a problem with the focus in the back, sometimes in the front of the frame or in the background. Things are really oddly out of focus. And so one weird problem in this, and I don't know if it was the director or maybe the second unit, but there's some glaring focal problems in this, the interior shots in this film. And definitely noticeable, does take you out of the film for sure. At this point, the pilot demands the use of a radio, and there's a Japanese Japanese crewman on board the Nimitz. And so Owen flips on the radio, and the Japanese translator's on the other end of the radio. So there are these demands that are met, and you know, the Japanese pilot says he wants access to a radio, obviously to warn the fleet of the presence of the Nimitz. And he agrees to it, basically to stall for time. Two of the Marines bust in, try to surprise him, but he kills one of them and then takes Laurel hostage and threatens to kill her if anyone tries anything else. And then Lasky urges Owen to tell the pilot exactly what's going on via the translator and everything that they know about what's about to happen. And it's a great scene because Owen is basically narrating history and the Japanese translator is translating for him. You know, he knows everything, all the code words, the names of the aircraft carriers, the code phrase that will start the attack, climb Mount Nikitaka, whatever. And it stuns the pilot. And you see also Sam Chapman overhears it and he's like, how the hell do you guys know all this? And the pilot's distracted enough to where, you know, the Marines then finally make the jump. Laurel gets away. He kills one more Marine, and then he's finally gunned down and killed himself. But now they're all revealed to Chapman, and kind of the jig is up in one sense. So now Chapman, being, you know, a senator who's, from his own admission, is part of the, you know, some very powerful armed services committee and, you know, the Department of Defense, and he, you know, it's through him a lot of, you know, money goes to the Navy and the armed forces. So he feels very entitled and he's trying to boss Yellen around and he demands a radio to call Pearl. And Yellen says, no problem. And he takes him to a radio room and he tries to call Pearl. And it's great because the guy at the other end says they've never heard of a Samuel Chapman. They've never heard of a Captain Yellen. There's no Nimitz in the fleet, so on and so forth. And he can't convince the guy. And the guy tells him to go fuck off and get off this channel. And it's great, you know, great moment because Chapman asks Yellen to get on the radio and explain things. And of course, Yellen won't do it. So now we get a little bit of the romance budding between Laurel and Owens comes into her room to get her, and, you know, he gave her some clothes and she's changing into Navy clothes and we get a bit about her and she charms the pants off of Ferrantino because she's got a lot of verve and she recognizes that it's tough for a woman in her day, but she's smart and tough and she doesn't give up and, you know, she's a good speechwriter and she's smart and Catherine Ross sells it. She's a good character. She doesn't have much part to play in this movie, but for her one scene with Owen here in this boardroom, like, yeah, she's solid, you know, and it's kind of cool. And what's great is we can see why he'd be charmed by her, because we are. So Chapman demands to be sent back to Pearl, and Yellen says, sure, we will. We'll send you back, no problem. But in an aside to Owens, he says, look, you know, I found one of the uncharted small islands in the Hawaiian chain. We're going to set him down there. And, you know, before this is all over, and then, you know, we'll go back and get him. Owens leaves in the helicopter with Chapman and Laurel, and basically he tells Owen when he leaves, like, you know, hurry back. I want my best, commander heading the fleet as we go into battle. So Yellen has decided that he is going to step up with the Nimitz and intercede in this historical moment. There's a closed circuit TV on the Nimitz, and Yellen kind of goes on. He explains the entire thing to the crew, tells them everything, where they are, what they're doing, and what his intentions for the battle is, that he's just going to go at the Japanese fleet, take them down. And we gather that with the Nimitz's incredible firepower that maybe not the entire battle fleet, but they could probably do an enormous amount of damage, as well as, you know, warn the Americans of Pearl Harbor. I mean, you think about what they could do in that moment, just from a, you know, historical perspective. And My God, they can fire and destroy half of the fleet from over the horizon before the Japanese even see them. They have Tomahawk missiles and all these kind of crazy things. The planes would be a joke. Most of the planes would be just shot out of the sky. And by that time, the American fleet would be steaming out of Pearl to mop up what was left and really be a non-event. It'd really be cool to if someone did a tie-in novel of playing out if the Nimitz had avoided the storm and just stayed in 1941. After that, what would they have steamed over to the Pacific, and would they have been able to replicate jet technology quickly? And I don't know. It's so speculative. Alternate history is so cool and so full of a lot of great writers and ideas. Basically, now we cut to the helicopter carrying Owen, Laurel Scott, Sam Chapman. They land on this atoll, and Chapman is like, "This isn't Pearl." And he's very suspicious about what they're going to do, and he steals a flare gun from inside the chopper. Owen and Laurel Scott get out of the helicopter, and they walk in there talking on the beach somewhere. He's probably explaining what's going on. Chapman knocks out one of the airmen on the helicopter and then puts the flare gun to the pilot's head and says, "You take off and get me to Pearl right now." The pilot takes off. Owen tries to get on the helicopter, and he falls into the sea, can't do it. And the pilot that Chapman had knocked out wakes up, comes up behind him, and there's a struggle for the flare gun. It goes off, and the helicopter explodes in a very spectacular fireball, stranding the CAG, Owen, and Laurel on the little atoll. However, they did leave their collie back on the Nimitz, so the dog is still back on the aircraft carrier. And there's a little plot point at the end of the film that comes up, which is kind of cool. So Yellen realizes what's happened. He can't spare any rescue craft at the moment because of what's to come. He's got every plane in the air heading toward the Japanese fleet. And we get dozens of repeated launchings now. We see basically all of his aircraft going up in the air. And, it's full court press and this wonderful aerial photography again. Some just beautiful shots. And, the more I see this film, the more I wonder if this is like a Michael Bay favorite because just the style of the music and the way these things are shot. I wonder if Bay really got a charge out of this when he was a younger man, and it's in his sort of filmic unconscious, as it were. Just reminds me of the military scenes of a Transformers movie. It's very funny. Bay went on to do a Pearl Harbor movie, which is kind of funny, which I did not see, but was panned pretty much universally. On the atoll, we're with Owens and Laurel Scott, and they look up and we see all the Japanese Zeros heading for Pearl. I think some of these shots were refurbed Zeros or replicas, basically. And then there were other shots that they got from this famous World War II film, Tora, 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 which was all about the sneak attack and bombing of Pearl Harbor. They spent a lot of money filming a lot of shots in that film. And so there was a combination of this. Some shots this film did, I think, a lot fewer. Some shots from Tora, 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 and, of course, obviously some documentary shots as well. So they see the planes, and then we see the storm reappears. It's closing fast on the Nimitz, and Yellen tries to maneuver out of its way and discovers that the storm is heading for the Nimitz. Regardless of where it maneuvers, the storm follows. So Yellen has to scrub the attack and get all his planes back, and the Nimitz heads back through the storm. And as it's going back through the storm now, we're cutting with all of the bombing of Pearl Harbor images, and history is once again repeating itself because the Nimitz was unable to remain in that time period. A little bit of a tension device once they get through the storm again. All of the planes hadn't made it back to Nimitz airspace, so we don't know if they made it through the time portal. Another opening for alternate history novel of if they landed and all these planes landed at Pearl Harbor without the Nimitz. It'd be kind of cool. But of course, the big music swells and we get the big soundtrack thing and the planes arrive and, all the landings on the deck of the Nimitz, and there they are. So the last bit of this film is the Nimitz back at port, and we see this mysterious man again in the car. Basically, we see a bunch of things. So we see Yellen and his I guess the rear admiral or admiral of the Navy comes on board. He's like, "Training exercise, what the hell happened? You got four men dead, you've lost a blah, blah, blah." And Yellen follows him in, and we don't know what the hell he's going to tell him. Lasky comes out. He brings out the dog with him when he leaves the ship, and there's a brief moment between Lasky and Yellen. Lasky, you're a pain in the ass, but it was good to know you. And there's no connection, really, I mean, from any of these characters. They were all just, you know, props, as it were, in an extremely B film that's all about the concept and, you know, airplanes, basically. Lasky comes back, and that, you know, black limousine is waiting for him. And this time, the door opens, and the dog, all of a sudden, the ears perk up, and the dog runs and jumps in the back of the limo. Lasky leans over, and it's Owens and Laurel Scott, who survived all these years. And I guess with, you know, Owens' knowledge of history, he built Tideman Industries and wound up building the very ship, or, you know, making sure that the ship was built that brought him back to 1941. So kind of a nice Twilight Zone moment. But, of course, the dog knows him. And we get these shots of James Frantino and Catherine Ross done up with age makeup. So, you know, they're much older. And Owens is wearing a suit, so on and so forth. And we hear Laurel tell him, "Get in, Lasky. We've got a lot to talk about." And that's it. He goes away in the truck and goes away with them in the limo. And Final Countdown ends. You know, that's it. It's Final Countdown, not a lot of layers here. You know, solid B movie with above average aerial photography. I mean, it has A movie cinematography and filming. Incredible. Still holds up to this day. You know, you watch this movie and the aerial photography is top notch and beautiful to look at. And I think it will be ageless for some time to come. You know, the film doesn't really truck. The cool thing about the film is, you know, the decor and the costumes, it's sort of ahistoric. And what I mean to say is, you know, sometimes when you watch even military movies in the 80s or 90s, whatever, there's something about the way they're shot and the way they're done that even puts them in that time. They did this one so kind of economical and so straight up military that it does not feel dated. You know, the only dated bits are in the beginning before they get on the Nimitz. You know, we see older cars, so on and so forth. And there's no cell phone technology, obviously, and no computers. But when you're on the ship, I mean, for most of the movie, then you're in 1941. You know, it's kind of an ageless film. And it's shot so clearly and beautifully that, you know, it's kind of an empty movie and it's really nothing much to talk about. But yet it's still, for sci-fi, you know, fans, I think it's a film that will continue to just be rewarding to watch for years to come just because it's such a great concept. And it was done using the real Nimitz and I don't know. So to me, it still holds up. You know, it doesn't reach for very much, but boy, what it does reach for, I think it delivers on. And I think, you know, make some popcorn, put your feet up, and you're in and out in 90 minutes, and you have a good time and be very well entertained. That's my take on The Final Countdown. That is it for this episode. So I want to thank you all for listening. You can find us on Facebook. The website is scifionscreen.com. We're also on iTunes, and you can subscribe on iTunes. And as I upload episodes each week, if you subscribe, you'll automatically get them downloaded to your mobile device or your computer, wherever you listen to your podcasts. These days, a lot of mobile phones are being made and sold with podcast apps already part of the phone. And so you can click into one of those apps and look for scifionscreen.com, subscribe through your smartphone if that's where you listen to your podcasts. You can check us out that way. Thank you once again for listening, and looking forward to the next time.